You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Many productions of Macbeth have gotten rave reviews over the past 400 years, but I doubt any have been much more glowing than the one now at the Brooklyn Academy of Music is receiving. Ben Brantley of the New York Times has described Patrick Stewart's portrayal of the Thane of Cawdor, maddened suddenly by vaulting ambition, as a brilliant must-see performance, and several British critics pronounced it the Macbeth of a lifetime, the best they've ever seen. So it gives me great, great pleasure to welcome to this show now Patrick Stewart, who says he's been preparing for this role all of his life. Hi.
Hi, good morning, Leonard.
You've received wonderful reviews in the past, but has it ever been this good?
No. The past 2 years have been the grandest 2 years of my life. I made a choice to return to the theatre, but not just the theatre, but to classical theatre. And luckily, the Royal Shakespeare Company employed me 2 years ago and cast me as Antony in Antony and Cleopatra.
And you got fabulous reviews for that.
Yes, and I was, you know, I'd been away for a long time, and I'd been working primarily in North America, mostly in California, mostly on film and television. And I was fully prepared for them to say, well, you know, hang on a minute. You know, you've got to put some time in first. You just can't swan back to England and think you can step into a classical actor's shoes just like that. Also, on the opening night, the press night of Antony and Cleopatra in Stratford, right in the middle of my second scene, which was perhaps 7 minutes into the evening, the fire alarm went off and the theatre had to be cleared. And so all of us in Roman skirts and Egyptian diaphanous gowns were out there with the critics and the audience standing on a chilly March evening in Stratford-on-Avon.
Somebody must have thought that was a postmodern production note.
Well, I think in another place it might have been, probably not with the Royal Shakespeare Company. It couldn't have started worse.
Do you think that, because you started playing, doing an awful lot of Shakespeare, you were with the Royal Shakespeare before you went to Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that all of those years in television and film actually improved your skills on some level?
I think that everything that I've done during this career has resonated very beneficially in every other area. One of the things that the successful television series gave me was a different quality of confidence that I had lacked before. You know, I've I'm tempting fate here, I've essentially never been out of work in my life, which is unusual for an actor.
Most actors have to wait tables and stuff.
Yeah, I chose to work with permanent companies. I'd always been attracted to the idea of an ensemble, to a unit company, to be working with the same people month in, month out, year in, year out, and the same directors too, which is how it was with the Royal Shakespeare Company. And yet, outside that world of the RSC and classical theatre, I really wasn't known at all. So Star Trek The Next Generation had a big impact on my life, every corner of my life. And receiving that kind of acknowledgement and standing at the centre of such a successful television show, which was not meant to be successful, by the way. We were supposed to fail, but we did 7 years and 178 episodes of Next Generation.
So it was like joining another rep company.
It was exactly like being back in my provincial theater days. We were at first a unit of nine, then we became eight, then we became seven. And it was exactly like being in a rep company because week by week the episode changed, the stories were different, we had different visiting guest artists and so on. It was an enjoyable and fascinating and developing time because I grew too during that experience.
Well, you do mention that when you arrived to do the Star Trek series, the LA Times described you as an unknown British Shakespearean actor.
That's right.
That really had to hurt. Yeah. You'd been at the RSC for nearly 20 years at that point.
It hurt a little. That was the very first press announcement about the new series. And my dear friend Brent Spiner, who so brilliantly played Data the Android, he had a sign made which hung on my trailer door which said, "Beware, unknown British Shakespearean actor."
And you had also just been in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. So you really weren't an unknown.
But in Hollywood terms, really, I was, Leonard. You know, nobody knew who the heck I was in any sense. I'd made a few appearances in some classic BBC series, Smiley's People, Tinker Tailor Spy, I, Claudius. Mm-hmm. But unless you'd seen those programs, you wouldn't know who Patrick Stewart was.
So this production, which has really gotten such great reviews, opened at the Chichester Festival, then moved to a West End run, and now it's at BAM, a production that's only scheduled to go on till March 22nd, although there has been talk about trying to get it onto Broadway if they can. Is it pretty much the same cast from the start?
We lost a witch between Chichester and London. Only one of the three. So we had a replacement witch in for the entire London run, but she has come with us to Brooklyn, I'm glad to say. So it is the London West End company in its entirety at the Harvey Theatre.
And you have returned to BAM as well, although the last time you were at the other theater in a pretty famous production of Shakespeare, Peter Brook's legendary Midsummer Night's Dream.
Mm-hmm.
So do you like working in Brooklyn?
I love working in Brooklyn this time. It was a little different in 1971. And the people at Brooklyn were not aware of this. They welcomed me to BAM for the first time. You're going to love it here. And I had to tell them, well, this is actually the second. But we went in the other direction. The Peter Brook Midsummer Night's Dream, which was arguably the most famous Shakespearean production in the 20th century.
Well, many people feel it changed the way that play has been performed ever since.
Not just that play, but how you can perform Shakespeare. I would say, I'm going to modify what I just said, in the English language, I would say, because there was a lot of terrific work being done on Shakespeare in Europe at the same time. We went from Broadway to Brooklyn because we played at the then Billy Rose Theatre on 41st Street, where Rent has been playing all that time. I wonder if Rent knew that once that Peter Brook's Midsummer Night's Dream was in there. And Peter Brook insisted that if a Broadway season were to happen, that we would also do a season at BAM at reduced prices, because the Broadway prices even then were sky high. And we had people sitting on cushions. We were in the Opera House, which is a big space. But he also insisted that the chairs were taken out at the front so that students could just buy a cushion for a couple of dollars and sit there to see the show. But this was 1971, and whether it was the reputation of our company or whether it was the reputation of Brooklyn, I don't know. But we were bussed in from Manhattan. They didn't trust us. And I think they were right not to trust us, to find our own way from Midtown Manhattan to
But now
Brooklyn.
You can take the subway.
I take the subway almost every evening, yeah, from downtown into Atlantic Avenue.
You talked about the Opera House being large. Well, the Harvey is a huge theater as well. The one at Chichester is fairly small, isn't it? How many adjustments had to be made each time?
Oh, I think the Chichester Theater is something like 240. And it's got a very low ceiling. The production was designed for that space. And one of the things that we have never had since we left Chichester is the sense of claustrophobia. Really bad things happen in this play. In this production, truly horrendous things happen. It is a shocking thing to witness. I've never seen it, but people report back to me that it's disturbing.
Bloody production, among other things.
Very bloody, yes, there is a lot of blood. There have been bloodier productions of Macbeth, but there are things that get done that don't necessarily involve blood that are kind of unpleasant.
And Ben Brantley of the Times remarked that this production has enough flash, blood, and mutilated bodies to satisfy a Wes Craven fan.
Well, that's very kind of him. We're grateful to him for that.
That was a rave review, by the way.
It was a wonderful review.
So
it was actually read to me on the telephone on Valentine's night. I was sitting in a bar in Tribeca, nursing a whiskey and soda, and it was read to me over the telephone, and it was a 10-15 minutes, I think I will never forget. That bar will be for all time one of the happiest places of my life.
Because many actors don't want to read reviews, positive or negative.
Well, I have an arrangement with my publicists that they only tell me about the good ones. I'm too old now to read bad reviews, and they just depress you. I read one this morning. It was a terrific review, but it suggested that I was perhaps in places a little declamatory, I think was the word. And, you know, the good things in the review just faded into the background, because all the way here this morning, all I could think was declamatory. Is that true? I've got to do something about that. We are too vulnerable, you know. We should develop thicker skins.
Yeah, well, I think the performance is nuanced, and if it's declamatory at times, that's because it was required at times.
I hope so.
That works. It helps you a little bit.
I hope, because I think that what this production has is an intense naturalism and spontaneity that gives people the feeling that what they're seeing is truly happening for the first time.
Well, the whole sinister side of it becomes apparent the minute we see the set, which is...
it's certainly not a Scottish hillside, is it?
Absolutely not. Nothing royal here. We have this sinister, institutionally sterile space that serves, over the course of the play, as a morgue, a hospital ward, a battlefield, a dining hall, a kitchen, an interrogation room, a cabaret. And it has, as the joke goes, everything, including the kitchen sink.
Indeed, it has the eponymous kitchen sink. And... but I got to correct you. It ain't sterile. It's filthy.
yeah, and it has this... One of the most amazing concepts is this industrial freight elevator in the back. Was that in all the productions?
Yes.
So you had to install that?
Yeah, we have a new elevator here in Brooklyn. Whether this is something to do with regulations or what, I don't know, that they didn't trust our British elevator. But it is an industrial elevator, the kind of thing you'd see, you know, in the meatpacking district going up to some expensive loft. It was always there. It was always in the design. The format, the layout of the set did change. Anthony Page's set is quite astonishing, but it did change somewhat. But the elevator was always there.
But you can't imagine Shakespeare writing "Exeunt elevator."
No. He would have raised an eyebrow, I think, at what we have here.
I think actually he probably would have appreciated it, because it's theater. It's effective theater, and in the end, it gets across the whole idea of what Macbeth is about.
And he was an experimenter too. English theater had never been like that until he began to... Little sort of Trivial Pursuit footnote, by the way. The word assassination appears in the language for the first time in Macbeth.
Hmm. And it is definitely an assassination play. The director, Rupert Gould, is someone you've worked with before. Was this all his concept? This 1950s kind of Stalinist Russia totalitarian thing with, that kind of paranoid world and purges and all the things we associate with that horrifying time?
Yes, that was all Rupert's concept. I think in working with Anthony, our designer, they pushed that further. But when... You say I have worked with him before. I did a production of The Tempest with him, mm-hmm. which is traditionally thought of as being a kind of tropical island production, sand and palm trees, and at least somewhere that's relatively comfortable and warm. Well, Rupert came to me the very first time we worked together and said, how would you feel if this were set in the Arctic? and I didn't know what to say, because I couldn't envisage it. But as with the Macbeth, he brought an absolutely coherent and consistent approach to it. Yes, so I was in furs, and there were Inuit symbols everywhere, and ice floes on the stage, and people had, you know, frost on their beards and so forth. It was astonishing. And he's done the same thing with this Macbeth. But let me say that these are not gimmicks. When I'm talking to them like that, people are listening and thinking, oh, yeah, we've seen all this kind of stuff so many times before, a concept that's stuck on to a production. I'd really like to assure your listeners that both with the Arctic Tempest and the Cold War Macbeth, these are not stuck on. They are so organic to the production.
But there is something about Patrick Stewart, I imagine, and Shakespeare. You also were in Othello, where you played the white Othello in a to an all-black cast.
It was the only way that I could do it. I'd wanted to play Othello since I was 14. And when I was of an age and people might cast me, it was clearly not going to happen because no one was going to cast a white actor. And I thought, what was I going to do, put on blackface to do that? I don't think so.
Not anymore.
No. Although I think that probably in the next decade or two, we're going to see some interesting changes in that regard, with in terms of cross-racial casting or colorblind casting, as it's sometimes called. So, but I had this idea, what if the only white person in the play were Othello and everyone else was black? And what if they were not only black, they were African-American, so that you had a cultural difference as well? The director, who was an English woman, I asked to do this because I did some research and found that very few women had directed Othello. So why not go the whole hog in terms of controversy and have a white British woman direct it? She cast the whore as a white actress, and she cast the servants as white actors too. And in that sense was creating a very close social parallel of the time. And it was, we did this at Washington with the Shakespeare Theatre there, and it was one of the grandest, most moving and powerful experiences of my life.
My guest is Patrick Stewart, who's now starring in Macbeth at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, the Harvey Theatre at 651 Fulton Street. We'll talk about some of the other members of the cast and get into other matters, and who knows where we'll go in this conversation as we continue it after a brief break. We're talking about the Chichester Festival Theater's production of Macbeth, now at the Harvey Theater at 651 Fulton Street in Brooklyn. Harvey is part of BAM, of course, and it'll be running through March 22nd. And this is some of the music from this production. We're seeing more and more theatrical productions with their own music. Mm-hmm. This has been something that has only developed in my memory in the last 10 or 15 years.
Yeah, particularly as it applies to the classics. I would like, by the way, just for a moment to draw your attention, if I may, and your listeners' attention, to the bass line in the singing that you heard just there, because
that was you?
That was me.
Oh, congratulations.
Well, actually, no, it was four of us. There are four basses in our company. This is indeed the all-singing, all-dancing Macbeth, because
all bleeding.
Kate Fleetwood and I, we do polka in this production, and we do get to sing as well.
And people pointed out, of course, that Kate Fleetwood plays Lady Macbeth is about half your age. Not quite, but considerably younger. And first it seemed perhaps that would have been a mistake, but it turns out to be brilliant casting. They really does feel like this is one of those May-December relationships that gets very passionate. And mm-hmm. she comes across as a trophy wife who's married up.
Mm-hmm. I hear what you're saying, Leonard. I don't see myself as December yet. Could we settle for maybe
November.
October. Early October.
Late fall.
You were asking how did all this begin. I think, and I'm sure Rupert Gould would not mind, if I were to take credit for this age discrepancy casting. I had indeed at one point thought of it as being an even larger gap between the two of them. The reason being that people are already suggesting that I'm a little old to play this part, and that no comments about the production have irritated me more than that, for the simple reason that in this play, unlike Hamlet, for example, where there is a specific age that's mentioned, There is no way of knowing how old either Macbeth or Lady Macbeth are. Nothing. Not a hint anywhere. So he can be any age.
And your Macbeth comes across as a man who had made peace with himself, with the idea that he would rise no further. And now suddenly he's in this situation where there is an opportunity and he has a young, ambitious wife.
Exactly.
And it makes a lot of sense.
Exactly. He is in a great place in his life, in his career, in his status. He's just won two spectacular battles. He's been honored by the king. He's been given another great award. He's now Thane of Cawdor. He has, it would seem, everything for a successful general's life and career. But he has a wife who wants more. Now, I'm not saying that this is what wives want. This is this particular wife. She's young. She's ambitious.
She could be the queen.
And she wants it all. She wants to be in the White House. She wants to be in Buckingham Palace. And he is madly in love with her. And I find that because we have this age difference, and Kate is very beautiful, because she is the driving force in the early scenes, her ability to influence him and persuade him is partly because of his devotion and attraction to her. And as you may have noticed, that we have a strong sexual connection. Poor Kate gets pawed by me. I've never in my career has an actress been as handle as much as I have to handle her, and she does it with such good grace.
I'm sure you say to her, it's not my fault. The director told me to do it.
Well, you know, the director happens to be her husband. So I passed all these things before him before I put my hands anywhere. You know, because this is a kind of volatile situation.
My guest is Patrick Stewart, who is starring as Macbeth at the Harvey Theater in Brooklyn, the part of the BAM complex. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Macbeth and Captain Jean-Luc Picard of Star Trek The Next Generation are both military men. Wasn't your father a military man as well?
He was.
Is he in the back of your mind when you're playing those two very different kinds of characters?
Leonard, he's not in the back of my mind. He's right there in the forefront. Especially with this play at the moment, because my father had a moustache, and this is radio, but I have grown a moustache for this role. My father's moustache was finer and thinner than mine. He had been a regular soldier throughout the 20s. He'd served with the British Army in India. He was on the Northwest frontier. He was in Afghanistan. And I, as a child growing up, I was fascinated by his tales of the Northwest frontier. Of course, now everything is very, all of that is very much back in the news again. Regrettably. And then in 1939, he joined up again to fight in the war, and he became a superstar. He finished his military service as Regimental Sergeant Major of the Parachute Regiment. That makes him the senior non-commissioned officer in the entire regiment. He stood at the pinnacle. And from what I understand, he was brilliant at it. He was a man of terrific personality. No education, but great personality, outstanding authority. He was a wonderful raconteur, very impressive, and also, after the war, in later years, unhappy man. Unfulfilled in what he did. You know, how do you go from being the top guy in the regiment to you know, painting bridges on the railways? It's hard.
You yell at the kid.
Yeah, you yell at the kid. So, yeah, we got yelled at a lot. But he had many outstanding qualities. And it was only a few years ago that I realized that I had been drawing on my father and my knowledge of him and his life and his world for years and years and years. But never more so. He was in Captain Picard. He never saw Captain Picard. He was dead before I went to Hollywood in 1987. And he would have, I think, appreciated Picard's command style. I think it was very close to how my father operated. But in terms of his volatility and the violence that was in him, he would certainly, I think, recognize himself in Macbeth.
And you say that you memorized Macbeth when you're 13 years old. This is one of those roles that you actually been preparing for a long time. But you grew up in Yorkshire. not all that far from where Ian McKellen grew up. Isn't that true? And the two of you, did you know each other when you were young? Because here you are competing for this year's Olivier Award for Best Actor. Mm. He for King Lear, you for Macbeth. And by the way, the third actor did Othello. This is amazing.
That's right. Chiwetel Ejiofor is also a nominee for Othello. So there are three Shakespeare roles. It's been a great year for Shakespeare in London this past year.
And then you and he have butted heads in X-Men.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we are Magneto and Prince Professor Xavier. The two opposing forces in the X-Men series. No, I didn't know Ian when I was growing up. He is actually, and it's important that I mention this. He's a Lancastrian. He was born west of the Pennines, which makes him a Lancashire boy. I was born but we were only a few miles apart. Our accents were similar. The timbre of our voices is actually quite similar. And at times, vocally, we are taken one for the other. Ian, however, has a magnificent head of hair, and so there's little chance of us being visually ever mistaken. I've only worked with him once on the stage. We did a world premiere of a Tom Stoppard play, Every Good Boy Deserves Favour. That's the only time we worked together until we went to Hollywood to do the X-Men series. I cannot begin to utter what it is, but the most exciting thing has happened that might just bring the two of us together on to the same stage sometime in the next 18 months. And if it happens, it will be, I think, if that's the end of my career, it will be the cherry on the top. And he's in this production. He was a famous Macbeth, Ian, in the 70s with the Royal Shakespeare Company, with Dame Judi Dench. And I met him in the street one day while we were rehearsing, and he said to me, just one thought for you, Patrick. The speech tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. Yes, I said, Ian. Well, he said, the important word is and. Bingo, because I got it instantly. Yeah. And that moment is right in the production, and it's entirely Sir Ian McKellen.
Well, I've always wondered about what happens when you come to those famous lines, the Shakespearean lines. You really cannot hit them hard. There's enough recognition factor from the audience, but there they are. To be or not to be has to be. Luckily, you never, or you, well, you regret that.
No,
unfortunately,
no. I never had to face that challenge. I wish I had. I'm ready for it now. Bring on a Hamlet production. I'll play that if we could only find some solution to it in the way that we did with the Othello. Macbeth is thick with famous quotable lines, or purple passages, as some people call them. My first line is, so foul and fair a day I have not seen. My last line is, lay on, Macduff, and damn be he that first cries hold enough. And in between,
there's sound and fury signifying nothing, and all sorts of other things like that.
So, what do you do? You try to give the impression that they are newly minted, fresh, spontaneous, that they spring up out of the feeling, out of the situation, out of the relationships, that until you open your mouth, you don't know what you're going to say. It just happens that, is this a dagger, which I see before me, comes out of your mouth instead of, what the hell is that? I did actually happen. I got it. We had one night in Chichester, and I dried. I went up on a line, and it's the line when I'm in the scene with the doctor, and I say, can you not minister to a mind disease? And he says, therein the patient must minister to himself. And the response is, throw physic to the dogs. Oh, none of it. And throw physic to the dogs went. But I knew what the purpose was, so I said, to hell with medicine. And all I got from lovely Paul Shelley, who plays the doctor, was one slightly raised eyebrow.
But the audience understood the scene a little better.
The sense was there.
And that is what actors do all the time. But when it's Shakespeare, you're fooling around with the real thing.
Well, no, the good thing is that unless it's something very, very famous, and throw physic to the dogs is famous enough, a lot of audiences don't know. All of us admit the important thing is just to keep talking, not stop. If you stop, the audience sense something's up. Keep talking, and eventually you'll find your way back to the blank verse.
Is it your are your plans to do theater almost solely again? I know next year, Stratford, you'll be playing Claudius in Hamlet.
Well, that's as close as I'll get. The brilliant actor David Tennant is going to be playing Hamlet.
Oh, how wonderful.
And I'll be standing alongside watching him. I'm playing Claudius for the first time on the stage. I did it for the BBC on television years ago when Derek Jacobi played Hamlet. Yeah, and you know what? With this play, for the first time in 3 years, I am not carrying the play. Claudius is a supporting role. It's a great role. But there's a sense of relief in me that come, you know, 6 o'clock in the evening, you don't have to think, oh, do I have to lift this thing up and carry it on my shoulders for 3 hours? David Tennant could be doing that. That will go through next year, and then there are more Shakespeare plans. I don't want to change what's going on at the moment because it's giving me so much pleasure.
On the other hand, there is that fame that you have gotten from television, from movies.
Oh, sure.
And you're riding the subways. Do people come up to you and talk to you?
No. You know, it's,
they respect your privacy.
I don't think it's a case of being respectful, though here in New York people are. I just don't get noticed. I ride.
They don't recognize you without your hair?
Well, I have a lot of caps. I have my company called my mugger's hat that I wear. I can travel on the subway in the underground in London, the subway here, and I love doing it because I believe in using public services, and I just pass by unnoticed.
Patrick Stewart is starring along with an amazing cast: Kate Fleetwood, Suzanne Burden, Michael Feast, Scott Handy, Bill Nash, Mark Rawlings, Paul Shelley, Tim Treloar, Martin Turner. Have I left anybody important out?
Well, they're all important, and you have left some of them out. You haven't mentioned our three witches, Neve and Sophie and Polly. We are an ensemble, and it's really important that I say that. The performance I give could not happen without the other 17 actors.
And the production is directed by Rupert Gould, designed by Anthony Ward, an amazing design. Video and projection design is Lorna Heavey. And it's all at the Harvey Theater at 651 Fulton Street in Brooklyn now through March 22nd. And there are people, since I think the run is pretty much sold out, there are people already praying that a Broadway theater will be made available at least for a little time.
Watch this space.
Thank you so much, Patrick Stewart.
Thank you, Leonard.
Yeah.